The 2009 psychological horror movie Haunting in Connecticut is based on a true story. Alan and Carmen Snedeker move into a rental property only to experience the most horrendous ghostly attacks you could ever imagine a family going through.
How much of the movie is based on the real haunting of this family? It's one of Ed and Lorraine Warren's most famous cases. Join us as we take a deep dive for the truth behind the haunting in Connecticut. Welcome to this week's episode of True Hauntings. My name is Renata Daniel.
And I'm Anne Rekovich, and we can't wait to bring you this episode.
Anne and Renata have been investigating paranormal occurrences for the past 20 years. They have been at the center of various unexplained phenomena and have witnessed countless ghostly experiences. The duo now turn to high-profile cases that have attracted the eyes of the world. Between the dimensions we see and the dimensions we don't, supernatural forces are at play. Evil lurks within the shadows of our homes and in the darkest corners of our minds. It follows us like a shadow, forever. This is where nightmares become reality. This is True Hauntings.
Hi, Anne. Welcome back to the studio.
Oh, it's so nice being back in our little air-conditioned little hidey hole.
Yeah, it's getting hot now, isn't it?
It is, it is.
But didn't this story that we're covering today just trigger a lot?
It did. I actually needed to take an extra week to do it because it was just obscene. It really was.
I want to get this story out, and I want to forget about the family and the whole story.
And we're going to have a little say at the end of it. It's exactly how we feel, aren't we?
Oh, we're going to have a say all the way through it. So hang on to your hats.
Now let's
for
not
this
give
one.
Anything away just
no,
yet.
No, no, no.
Yes, just yet. No. All right, Renata.
Okay, let's get on with the story.
According to those who have witnessed them, no two exorcisms are alike, although they all have two things in common, one of which is unforgettable to all those involved, whether it is an exorcism of a person or a building: the presence. It is invisible, ethereal, and yet felt so deeply by everyone involved that it seems almost tangible. It is a presence neither female nor male, neither human being nor animal, neither a single entity nor a crowd of them, but it is distinct and, as the exorcism continues, usually becomes stronger. If and when it speaks, it sometimes refers to itself as I, sometimes as we. It moves around those present like an ice-cold breeze, a draft from the depths of the deepest cave in the earth, until the exorcism is over, until the possessing entity has been cast out in the name of God. The second thing all exorcisms have in common is the most threatening: danger. Those participating in an exorcism are in constant danger and must anticipate hearing the foulest insults and seeing the most frightening things they are likely to experience in their lives. Their faith must remain rock solid in the face of horrible supernatural abuse. Demons will not uproot themselves without a powerful fight, and their chief weapon, as always, is fear. They feed on it and will do anything they can to wring it out of those involved in the attempt to cast them out. Not all such attempts are successful. Demons wait for an invitation before their entry, but they don't always leave when told. And that soundscape today comes from a book called In a Dark Place. And I have to say that blazoned across the cover, bigger than the title, are the words Ed and Lorraine Warren. in very small print down the bottom. It says, I've got the wheeze out within seconds. Carmen Reed and Al Snedeker with Ray Garten in tiny little print down the bottom.
Oh, damn.
So remember all those names because they're all going to come out in our story today.
Oh, they are.
Oh, they're coming out.
So the movie, The Haunting in Connecticut, is based around this house. It's a it looks like a suburban house in Southington. I think that's how you would say it, Southington, Connecticut. And it's been really the subject of a book, a TV movie, a theatrical movie, various documentaries, various more books. And one of the main characters that lived through this process became a psychic healer and a modern-day psychic.
She's in the biz
now. And, yeah, so it has spawned so many offshoots.
Oh, yes.
In so many ways.
It's just spread like weeds.
That's right. Right. Now, let's go back to the house itself. Like I said, it looks like just a suburban house, but in actual fact, it's a little bit more than that. It's multi-storied and it's recognised by the National Register as a historic neighbourhood that it sits in, Hartford County. It was built in 1916 and... It's a rental property now, so it's broken up into different sections, and that will make sense when we talk about the family living in the basement.
Oh, so they're in a unit sort of thing that's been made into the house.
So it's big enough to be partitioned off and made into several other apartments, and as I said, that's not the original use for the house. The original use for the house was a funeral home.
Ooh.
So for several decades, beginning in 1936, the house did serve as Hallahan Funeral Home, and the funeral home eventually moved to Plantsville, Connecticut, somewhere in the 1980s. So we've got kind of almost 40 years of it being a funeral home. The property was purchased by Darryl Kern of Kern Realty, and he had plans for the house. It was vacant for a little while. He wanted to make it possibly a hospital office building because it was close to the hospital, and that was one of the reasons the Snedeker family decided to move in there. Mm-hmm. But because of zoning issues, he couldn't do that. So he transformed the house into a duplex, and apartments were broken up between upstairs and downstairs. And this is now when the Snedeker family move in. So they move in 1986, Carmen and Alan, along with their four kids and some nieces and nephews and things. Yeah. So there are a couple of kids that came in.
It's an extended family.
Yeah. And they located from their home in upstate New York to live closer to John Dempsey Hospital at the University of Connecticut Health Center in Farmington because their eldest son, Philip, was suffering from Hodgkin's disease, Hodgkin's lymphoma.
And that's what my little cousin Chloe had. It's a type of cancer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And they used to travel every day to the hospital. It was hours.
Wow.
And apparently it made Philip feel really nauseated the whole way through.
Oh, can you imagine going through chemo and then having to travel hours as well?
So they decided that they would literally get the whole family and pack up everything and move as close to the hospital as they possibly could.
Oh, good on them.
So because they were in such a financial state, as anyone going through cancer in the family would be.
Particularly in America where the health system doesn't cover it.
Yeah. They needed to look for somewhere that was really, really affordable. And they found this particular place. It had been on the rental market for a little while. They went through it and had a look and decided that this was the place to be. I dare say it was a quick decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they thought they'd just grab it, especially because it suited them financially as well. So they moved in on June the 30th, 1986, and they went into the downstairs area, which included the basement, mm-hmm. which was one of the only spaces that was big enough for the boys to live right. in. Right. So it's said, and it's stated in the notes, that the Snedeker family were not aware that it had been a funeral home.
Hmm.
Only once they moved in and they started to move all of their belongings in, did they realise that the rooms downstairs were partitioned off with woodworking things.
Yep.
Once they started to pull all the things out and clear out the space.
Yeah, I think they're making a bedroom for Philip down there. Yeah.
Did they realise that some of the items from the old funeral home were still down there in the basement?
And I do remember that in the movie, because I watched the movie a long time ago and I remember them pulling the walls down and finding like the mortician slab and everything like that. But I don't think that's what was left, was it? It was only a couple of bits and pieces.
Well, apparently a blood drainage pit.
Mm-hmm. That's a drain.
A box of coffin handles.
Yep.
And a casket lift.
So that would just be a dumb waiter.
The thing that lifts the carcass.
Yeah.
The carcass. The casket up so you can put it in and out of the car, I guess.
Or something like that. It's a lift. Yeah.
So as you said, the area became a bedroom for Philip and his younger brother, Brad. And look, honestly, to begin with, from the information that I know, the boys didn't really make too much of a fuss about it.
Mm.
You know, I guess they were just happy to be down there and have their space.
As well.
Yep. Shortly after moving into the house, the Snedeker's eldest son, Philip, started to complain that he was seeing shadows and hearing voices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He told his mum that he would also see a man dressed in a black and white pinstripe suit.
Right. Slender man, maybe? No.
No, just a man in a black and white pinstripe suit. Now, he also asked to stay at the hospital rather than coming home. And he complained that he wasn't getting enough sleep because there was something going on in that bedroom.
Oh, well, with teenage boys, there often is.
Now, interestingly, I don't get a lot of information about the other son.
Yeah, I have to admit, I didn't even know that there was another son that was living in the room with him because it only ever refers to Philip.
Yeah, because like I tried to look for a whole lot of information and I couldn't see anything about Brad.
Poor Brad. He's feeling left out. He wasn't possessed.
Philip was getting all the attention from whatever it was down there. And look, it proceeded to get really, really dark as time went on. So there were, and again, this was one of these cases where I couldn't find a lot of information about what actually happened during their stay or not a lot of information written down of what actually happened during their stay in the house.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the book mm-hmm. in a dark place, but I'm going off what would have been recorded and what you could sort of look up reasonably
there's
quickly.
There's YouTube clips of interviews and things like that. There's some very interesting YouTube clips.
Yeah. So part of what they said that they experienced there were unexplained sounds, foul odours, sudden drops in temperature. Now, Carmen and a female niece named Tammy, who was staying with the family in the house, reported being touched by unseen hands. And it included also an incident where Carmen felt one hand clamp over her mouth while another yanked her hair. And later claims involved violent attacks on the family members and specifically the women who said that they were being raped and sodomized by demonic forces. So that's pretty full on.
And how long did they stay there for?
Well, the interesting thing is they stayed on after all of this happened.
Yeah, they were there for 2 years.
Another 2 years. So the whole incident didn't take that long because what happened was that Philip wasn't getting any better.
Mm-hmm.
His cancer was getting looked after mm-hmm. and he was recovering from that. But he went to a very deep and dark place and they believe that he became quite schizophrenic. And he changed the way he looked. He wore dark clothing.
But how old was he at this time?
17.
So you think of a 17-year-old boy that has been made dreadfully ill by Hodgkin's lymphoma, and when the treatment is quite often worse than the disease, but it was the only thing that's going to save him. So he's been made feel weak and powerless. I imagine there would be a bit of acting out there that he would try to change his persona to look strong and take back his life, really. It's a rebellion. He's had to rely on other people to clean up his sick and change his clothes for him and do whatever was needed because of his cancer. And I think it would be a rebellion.
Yeah, no.
No?
No.
Okay. This was just shoot me down in flames, well, whatever.
Well, according to the story, this is worse than rebellion because he was acting out on all the other members of the family.
Right.
He was actually caught wandering through bedrooms at night. And so there were attacks from him on family members.
Yep.
And so they actually got him to move out of the family home, thinking that, I don't know, maybe the stress was causing all of these weird things to happen. And so once he left the family home, maybe it would be a better atmosphere in the house. Mm-hmm. But that was not to happen because after he actually did leave the home, the paranormal activity just got worse for the rest of the family.
Allegedly.
Carmen said she was mopping the kitchen floor at one stage and she noticed the water turned blood red. And there were horrible odours coming out of the room.
Yeah.
Now, I remember actually seeing her talk about this on one of the documentaries that she was on because they were asking her what this red was.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it was really just red and sticky like blood.
Oh, yuck. But there, look, just to be devil's advocate yet again, I know that when we worked at Quarantine Station Manly, there with the morgue was there and they had a blood drain that was underneath the slab and it used to get very stinky in there and it's because of the old sewer pipes and the way they were built is that the smell would come back up.
Don't be disrupting my story.
I'm so sorry.
We're getting to that in your part.
Okay.
I'm just telling the story.
This is logic stuff. Oh, yeah, this is true.
We don't want logic right now. So there were crucifixes that were hung around the location throughout the house and they slowly began to vanish and some turned upside down. And others were found on the floor. Yeah. A rosary that Carmen had placed around her neck was yanked from her one particular night and all the beads were scattered around the floor and she had scratches all over her. There were several demonic entities that made their presence known over the next few weeks and Carmen said they were really, really powerful. One was very thin with high cheekbones, long black hair and pitch black eyes. Eyes. Sounds like Cher.
She's down. She's running.
Sorry.
If I could turn back time.
And there was another one with white hair and white eyes, and they wore a pinstripe tuxedo. What's with this pinstripe tuxedo?
So she has corroborated what her son has said.
Yes.
So they've got together.
Yeah, okay. Because she actually says his feet, whoever this entity was constantly in motion and this was seen by my son and I.
Feet? Yeah. Did you say feet?
Feet. Feet.
So a bit like me that has restless feet and I have to rub my feet all night.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So the most disturbing thing about it all was this change in Carmen's son, who was pretty academic, but like you said, he was suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma. So that would have changed everything for him. And he was getting increasingly angry, violent. He started to write disturbing poetry. He wrote graphic descriptions of sexual activity with dead bodies.
Oh, ew.
The family would have these foul smells go through the house all the time, like rotting flesh or excrement.
Poop. You say poop.
A dark mist enveloped Carmen and her niece one time when they were standing in the kitchen, and it literally felt like they were disoriented and it had paralyzed them. Carmen began to recite the Lord's Prayer and the demon vanished, releasing the women. Carmen was at her wit's end by this stage, and so she reached out to Ed and Lorraine Warren.
I'm calling the Warrens?
Begging them for help. So the Warrens were known by this stage because of their work with the Amityville Horror, which was in the 1970s. Yeah.
Late 1970s.
Books were written. They had gone on to go on TV documentaries and everything. So Carmen reached out to the people who she believed would help them the most. And, of course, the Warrens were well known for their work with demons.
Oh, very well known.
And exorcising demons. And they also brought in John Zaffis, which was the nephew, to be part of the investigation team. John says that shortly after they arrived at the house, they were all touched by the demons that were there, and it was this
why
whole
did I just
sense.
Have that song? Touch me.
He says they remember the vile odors that were coming out of the house all the time. He says the situation was pretty chaotic in there. John recalls one night I was sitting in the dining room table reviewing some notes that I'd made. Suddenly the room grew bitterly cold, and I could sense a presence around me. I think they were there for about 9.5 days in total, altogether. They were spread around the house, so they were sleeping in, you know, the living room, and they were just there 24 hours a day
I think they were there for a couple of weeks, actually.
To see what was going on. They believe they heard a sound that sounded like thousands of flapping wings coming towards them. That was not wings, people. That was not wings. And John says he was never more terrified in his whole life than he was.
He would have been
house.
Fairly young at that stage. Oh, hang on. Middle age, youngish. Young to us.
So Lorraine said she felt an evil presence in the house.
I bet she did.
She spent a night in the master living room. There was a trap door where the coffins were brought up. God. And that would have been horrendous. And during the night, you could hear the chain hoist. And there's actually a picture that was in the newspaper of this chain hoist.
I'll have to find it and put it up on the True Hauntings Facebook page that we've got.
Yeah, that would hoist the coffins up into what would probably be the room that would be...
Where they had the service.
Yeah, where they had
the
service.
Showing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the master bedroom. Oh, nice. Right. I'll have some sexy time in there. Oh, look at that dead body. Nice.
Stop. Now, a Catholic priest was brought in to bless the house. Now, this is where things get a little bit funny because...
Funny, haha.
I could not find in many of the reports any name to the priest.
Funny about that.
Now, there was one bit of information that I found that actually had a priest's name there.
Oh, yes.
But in no other piece of information is there the name of a priest that came in.
So much to dump. I'm so excited.
Yeah. Carmen and her husband were both attacked by the demonic forces. They would throw things around. The mysterious scratches appeared on the children's body. So it was decided that an exorcism would happen on the house. During the exorcism, the researchers were saying that the dishes rattled, picture frames rattled and shook. There were mysterious loud bangs from within the walls, but the house definitely felt lighter, and there was a smell of roses that came around the wall.
Nice.
And a sense of calm and release.
Somebody had sprayed some LSD in the air.
Yeah. So in all, the Snedeker family lived in this house for 2.5 years. So the first 6 months were the most horrendous, and then they stayed there for another 2 years. And Carmen states that no one who has lived there since their family has ever experienced any more paranormal activity.
Which seems to mean it's centered around that family and that family alone.
Yes, yes. So let me just read the last few sentences here. It's been almost two decades since these events took place. Since that time, Carmen has been approached by negative forces, but her unwavering faith and unflinching courage has kept the evil energies at bay.
She's such an angel.
No one will ever really know why the house was haunted while we were there, Carmen said. We did discover, however, that one of the men who worked in the funeral home was guilty of necrophilia. So perhaps his heinous action stirred up the demonic forces. I could not find anything.
No, neither could I.
To say that that was the truth.
Mm-hmm. Funny about that.
Now, remember when I talked about the poem that her son, the poetry her son was writing about him doing things to dead bodies?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, so we've got a bit of a link there. Mm-hmm. Do you think he was influenced by the said necrophiliac?
Possibly. Let me just finish this one sentence.
Oh, she's got a cheeky look on her face. She's excited.
So this was one of the most significant cases I've ever worked on, said John Zaffis. Without hesitation, it proved to me beyond any doubt that the demonic forces are very real.
Or are they?
So I've got 12 pages of information here. Most of them all saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the juiciest bits would probably have been from newspapers, which I couldn't download because...
Yeah, I couldn't either. I tried.
Yeah, you have to subscribe to everything to be able to download it.
You have to pay for everything. How dare they?
So, but I did find a lot of stuff that curled my toes and raised my eyebrows and... I'll let you talk about this. I wanted to get the story out.
Yeah, yeah. Renata's got a new perm out of this. Her hair is curled so much.
It was like, it's distressing.
It is very, really, really very distressing.
But yes, that's the story.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, hang on to your knickers because we're going for a big ride on this one.
Oh, we're going dark.
Hello, my little darklings. If you're anything like me, you sign up for things and forget about them. You commit to things and never go back to cancel those things once you've tested them or tried them out. And those things can weigh on you, man. They can just keep bleeding you dry, dollars at a time, and you don't even notice. Well, that's why I decided to take back control of my money, and I reached out to Rocket Money. I found subscriptions I had forgotten about, and on some of them, I was paying two or three times, and I didn't know what to do. But Rocket Money sure did. They stepped right in. Did you know that nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about? So before I started using Rocket Money, I thought I had maybe about 10 to 12 subscriptions out there, and I couldn't believe it when they showed me what I was paying for. I was paying over 22 different subscriptions each month, most of which I wasn't even using or remembered signing up for. So between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it's never ending. But thanks to Rocket Money, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved up to a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/P60. That's right. Take control of your financial future. rocketmoney.com/P60. rocketmoney.com/P60. Hello, my little darklings. The year is off to a great start for me. I hope it is for you as well. And you know what? Part of the big change for me is eating better, eating right, and getting the right portion, the right meals, and treating myself the way I should be treated, with delicious foods, not some processed garbage, but actually chef-selected, handcrafted meals that make me feel like I'm eating like a king. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. Huh? Huh? Who likes feeling rushed? 2 minutes, they've got their meal. You can settle in, relax, and enjoy eating the meal now. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. I got to tell you, this week we had some of the best food I've had in a long time. I got the char-grilled burger and mushroom cream sauce, followed up this week with black pepper and sage pork chop and the creamy Parmesan chicken. Mwah! Chef's kiss. It is to die for. And for my daughter, who doesn't like meat, she's a vegetarian, I got her the tomato and roasted vegetable risotto and the spicy sweet potatoes and peanut sauce. She was in heaven. Absolutely loved it. She was skeptical. Dad, not another microwavable meal. No, honey, you're right. Not another microwavable meal. This is delicious. And she now is a firm believer. 2 minute meals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. And you can get pancakes, smoothies, and more. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and so much more. Sign up and save. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. So do it, my darklings. Join me, eat healthy, and eat delicious food. Head over to factormeals.com/P6050. That's factormeals.com/P6050. And use code P6050 to get 50% off. That's code P6050 at factormeals.com/P6050. You're going to get 50% off. You're welcome, my darklings. A link for this appears on today's program guide. So please support the advertisers who support our show.
So getting into this one, I was just saying to Renato, I don't even know where to start because there are so many tendrils,
yes,
shall we say. Yeah.
It's like the story itself of actually what happened loses itself completely in the story of what happens afterwards.
Yeah. And I will point out possible bias as we go through and we have a little dig through the story. But maybe I should start with the people that own the building. Yeah?
Yeah.
So this is the landlady and the people that own the building and take rent.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, they're going to say that the whole story is ridiculous, right? There's nothing there. But the bias there is they need to be able to rent this property out to pay their bills. So, yeah. Of course, they're going to say there's nothing to it.
Yeah.
But she said that nobody before them had experienced anything bad. And then after they left, nobody experienced anything bad. And I did like this quote from one of the articles that I was reading up on where it says, apparently being assaulted and raped by Satan's minions for months at a time wasn't good enough a reason for them to break the lease. They were quite happy to stay there.
Yeah, they did.
I thought that was hilarious. But the actual landlady said the reason why they were almost evicted. They didn't quite get evicted, but it was because they weren't paying their rent.
Yes, that is true. They weren't paying their rent.
And as you said, they were having financial difficulties because of the son who had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why they all of a sudden started claiming there was ghosts and demons. Her husband said it's a fraud, it's a joke, it's a hoax, it's Halloween, it's a scheme. Everything is about making some money.
Now, they also said that they never heard anything from the Snedekers until it went public.
Yeah, I didn't know about that, but they said that the ghostly activity, the paranormal activity, conveniently escalated at the time they got behind in their rent.
Ah, right.
Yeah. And they moved out before they got evicted. Right. So they're, as I said, the bias of the landlord. They've got to be able to rent this place again.
Yep.
But then we have the thing that they're not paying their rent and they're claiming the house is haunted. So that would be allegedly a reason that they shouldn't have to pay their rent because they're being terrorised.
Yes, yes.
So then I thought we might go on to the neighbours.
Yes.
Let's have a look at the neighbours. Now, there's a couple of neighbours. There's the one called Kathy Altimus, who lived across the street. And she started to actually keep a journal of the events.
Yeah, she seems to me like the neighbour that looks through the, the curtains.
She'd have her cup of tea or coffee and she'd be peering through the curtains. Oh,
that's so what are they doing this
those
week?
Those snidickers are doing it again? What's going on over there? Oh.
Yep.
Now, she seemed to think that the snidickers had some sort of plan before they even moved in. She'd got this thing in her head that these people had planned all these demonic activity things happening because they were going to make a fortune. They've found a really good place to move into that has a great history. Now, she claims that some of the haunting claims, so there was that sound of the clanking chain.
Yes.
She said it was either the old coffin, they were claiming it was the coffin lift in the basement that could be heard, but she said in her journal that passing trucks would go past and it would sound like there was a train dragging. So
I've never heard of that with a passing truck, but anyway.
No, but I have, because sometimes if it's an empty truck going past, they'll have chains and things which are loose and they will make that sort of racket as they go past.
The chain that lifts the coffins or lifted the coffins does exist though. So it is a thing in the house.
Now I'm just trying not to reveal too much too soon.
We don't want to come too soon, eh?
Always a problem.
Spoils everything.
More for the fellas than it is the ladies. You started that one. I'm just saying.
Dear. Okay.
All right. So I've got to put a little mark to come back to that one. Now, there's also an upstairs neighbour.
Yes.
All right. Now, that's Sandy. Sandy lived upstairs and she shared the duplex with them. And she said, I haven't seen or heard anything supernatural in the building. I haven't heard a thing. Sandy has
That's
also...
That's because they were supplying her with drugs. But never mind. So,
Sandy also has been an employee of the real estate agency that the family had employed to find their new home. So, of course, she's going to say,
there's nothing going
on. There's nothing here. I didn't do anything wrong. Don't sue me. No. So she has bias in that area.
Yep.
But she could also be right. There could be no paranormal activity. And as for the claim that Carmen and Al were unaware of the place being a funeral home, she said they did. They absolutely knew. And there was even a story that the sign was still up on the wall that said whatever it was, funeral home. But the Snedeker said, oh, no, that sign was covered by a bush, which means they knew it was there because they found it. Covered by a bush. So then we have sort of that sort of inconsistency. All right, now who else have I got here? I've got so many pages of notes. Oh, now I have another neighbour for you. This one's name's Joan. Joan Mirabel. Oh, isn't that just such a lovely
name?
It's
beautiful.
So there was this neighbour who actually witnessed something herself. So I really like the idea that it's an external person that has witnessed something. So Joan said she saw a mysterious green glow coming from one of their windows.
Oh.
Maybe somebody had a green lamp on? I don't know. As well as alleging that she was stung by a mysterious force when she visited the family home.
Okay.
Somebody pinched her. I wonder if they got her on the bottom.
Okay.
Mirabel told a local newspaper, I don't believe that they've made the whole thing up. Every time I've seen her on TV, talking about Carmen, the story became more and more involved and it just got bigger.
It sounds a little bit like, and they liken this story to the Amityville case.
Yeah. She also said that she had seen the Snedekers outside of their home in the middle of the night. But there was somebody else reported that they seemed to be quite happy and laughing and having a good time. So that's like...
That's after the drugs.
Now, Renata, we haven't got to that part yet. You're jumping in a little bit quick there.
Okay.
All right, so I've got to cross all that out now. All right. There's also now, but we can't take this person's story, Al Snedeker's sister. She also seemed to have experienced paranormal activity in the family home, and her name was Nancy Butcher.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you can't take the statement of somebody who was inside the car for a car accident. she's got family, so
we
can't have her. We're crossing her out.
I wonder whether she's got a brother called Com.
What? Oh, I've missed it. Now I've got to go back. I can't remember her name. What's her name? Oh, Butcher. God. Com Butcher. Save me, peoples, please. Right. Okay. Let me just get on to the family now. I'm going to start talking about the family. I'm leaving the best bits to last, and we know who that is.
You are.
Oh, because once we go there, there is no coming back.
No.
Right. So, as we said, the son was had to move. Glasses are fogging up.
Yep.
So this is Philip that seems to be quite the centre of everything that's going on. So he's had to move. He's sick. He's come to a new house. He's full of stress. On the very first night of sleeping there, supposedly. Now, you originally said there was nothing that happened for a while, but the report I read said on the very first night of sleeping there, Philip complained of hearing strange voices and anomalous sounds.
Mm.
It's a big word for a 17-year-old to use, isn't it? Mummy, I heard anomalous sounds last night. He described seeing the figure of the man in the pinstripe suit, as you said. He became so terrified that he begged to be allowed to stay at the hospital. So that was the reason he wanted to stay at the hospital, because he was so terrified of what was happening inside the house. Despite his insistence that what he was experiencing was true, Philip's parents dismissed his claim, suspecting hallucinations as a side effect of the cobalt treatment he was receiving for his illness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did try to look up the side effects of cobalt, and the closest I could come to any sort of mental health issues was depression.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing there about hallucinations or anything like that, but it can cause depression. Maybe our beautiful Danielle, who does all the research, can find out some more about that one. But I did have difficulty finding that. So after he moved into the basement, Philip's personality did say to change. He started to wear leather, and he started to get into the occult.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, of course, that means that there's going to be demons, doesn't it?
It is.
Now, there is a story that at one point he broke into the neighbor's house to steal a gun in order to harm his stepfather. Philip was the stepson of Al, so there was obviously some sort of issue going on between them that he went in to get a gun and harm him.
Again, very much sounding Amityville. Like the Amityville all over again.
With the father and the son, and he got the gun and pointed it in the father's face.
Yep.
Oh, once you get a good story, why not stick to it? And reuse it in other stories.
Oh, dear.
Mm. Now, there is also...
I didn't realise they were a blended family.
Ah, okay. So there's a little bit more to do with Philip, which will start to make sense for a lot of the phenomena that was happening in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But I might come back to that. I just want to leave you hanging. Right, so the mother... Right, this is Carmen.
Yes.
One of the things that happened to her, which I think we've all experienced at some stage in our life, if you have a shower with a shower curtain, those things can attack you. Telling you now, her shower curtain very quickly wrapped around me and I couldn't push it away, according to the article. Her only thought was that this thing was trying to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, those shower curtains, they stick to your body like nothing else, and you can't get them off. It's awful.
That is true.
Now, she was one of the ones that caused so much issue because her story kept changing
mm-hmm.
all the way through. She was asked, why didn't you leave the house? And she was saying, oh, because it would follow us. It followed us wherever we went. If they haven't left the house, how do they know it's followed them?
Yeah.
So she was saying it's pointless to move. Then on other occasions, she claimed that she was unaware of what was happening in the house and stating that it was the kids being tormented and not her.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not right.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I know, right? This is her telling the story. So it's there is all sorts of things going on in this house, and I don't think many of them are paranormal. Carmen seemed to supposedly experience all this terrible abuse, but this neighbour that we were talking about earlier said she often saw the family outside the house in the middle of the night saying they could not go back in. Yet, far from being terrified, as one would expect, after having supposedly experienced the atrocities, which they claimed, the family seemed perfectly happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were going outside and making sure that they were being seen. Mirabelle said that they never seemed to be afraid. They were always out there laughing and joking.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the nieces. Now, the nieces claimed to have felt a disembodied hand touch her in a sexual manner.
Mm-hmm.
She even alleged that an unearthly presence had raped her. Speaking about these abhorrent attacks, Carmen described how the entity laughed a hideous laugh when it went above her shirt and out the window. Now, there was an interview done with one of the nieces whose name was Tammy, and she actually refers to the Entity film, right?
Yeah.
So that's a film that was around that time. And she talks about how she loves that film, and they all really loved that film. A lot of the things that happened in this case mimic what happened in that movie.
Oh, right.
Almost like it was used for... Anyway. all right. So that's that bit done. So there is a possibility that the nieces were actually interfered with, allegedly, by Philip.
Mm-hmm.
So these poor girls, he was found wandering their bedrooms.
Yep.
And
yep, he was.
So if you look at the niece's claim where she says she felt a disembodied hand touch her in a sexual manner, is that Philip?
Mm-hmm.
So if you've been told stories that there's ghosts, you'd be closing your eyes and hiding and not wanting to look. Or is it her mind that is blocking it out? Who is doing this? Or is it the family covering up for Philip?
Mm-hmm. Could be any of those.
The most damning one to come into all of this is Garton, who wrote the book. Boy, where do I even start with him? There's some interviews with him which just blow up everything. But let me go back to the role of Philip in all of this. Now, in the book, Garton calls Philip Stephen. So if you hear them talking about Stephen, that was Philip. And he said he was caught fondling his cousins and was questioned by police afterwards. This led to Philip admitting that this was not the first time he had acted inappropriately with the female relatives. According to the book, Philip admitted to having performed such heinous acts habitually in secret at night without being caught, and that he even once attempted unsuccessfully to sleep with his cousin. After this shocking admission, Philip was taken to a juvenile detention centre where a psychiatrist diagnosed him as schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm. And this is not mentioned in the main story. They're just saying that because of all the things that happened from a paranormal perspective and the terror that he had to endure, that's what created the schizophrenia.
Mm. Or is it the other way around? So Philip admitted to having committed obscenities similar to those attributed to the demonic entities that said to reside within the family home.
Mm-hmm.
So was it the demons that taught him to do it, or was it his idea, or was it him all along?
Mm-hmm.
It could be said that Rather than being attacked by unseen supernatural creatures, the family was instead being abused by Philip, and that their fantastical claims were invented as a form of psychologically coping with what had gone down.
Mm-hmm. And look, you can understand the family's point of view. If this is happening and they're having a lot of trouble trying to sort out, and you know what a mother's guilt is like.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that he is unwell, and that is true, he was unwell, he was going through all of this stuff with the Hodgkin's lymphoma, and then having him act out, how as a mother do you deal with it? How do you deal with that split in that personality?
Mm-hmm. Apparently he was also using drugs.
Yes.
Which
not only him, apparently.
We'll get there.
Okay. Sorry.
All right, now I'm going to go to Ray Garton. I love Ray.
Oh, Ray. Ray just says it like it is.
Oh, boy.
Ray, get me out of here, Garton.
I don't know. Should I do the Warrens first before I hit up?
No. I've waited too long.
All right. So, Ray Garton in 1992... was commissioned to write the book In a Dark Place, The Story of a True Haunting. Now, he has been interviewed several times about what happened, what went down. So he was actually hired by Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Yes.
To work with the Snedekers and write the true story of their house from hell. He interviewed all the family members about their experiences and soon realised there was a problem. he said, I found that the accounts of the individual Snedekers didn't quite mesh. They couldn't keep their story straight. So, being a good writer, he's gone to the Warrens, he's gone to Ed and said, this doesn't make sense. This one's saying this one and this one's saying that, and it's completely contradicting each other. Ed's reply,
oh my God.
Oh, they're crazy, he said. You've got some of the story. Just use what works and make the rest up. Just make it up and make it scary. Mm-hmm. So he took what information he'd been given, plucked out the best bits of it, created a story, used what they could, made up the rest, and tried to make it as scary as he could.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Some of the Warrens' co-authors have reportedly since admitted that Ed told them to make up incidents and generally create scary tales.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that this happened with Amityville,
mm-hmm.
and it was big breaks for some of these authors.
Mm-hmm. I made lots of money.
Ray Garton, who wrote the Halloween released book, they released it at Halloween, how convenient, has basically gone on to say that he was not happy in the end, and it was all crap.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's not the only time that this has happened. There's also The Exorcist, which was apparently A Million Little Pieces, a book. And it's where they take those little bits of truth and make it into something much bigger. And we've done The Exorcist before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a really great interview by Damned Connecticut.
Oh, yes.
Oh, dear. There is so many good books, bits here. All right, I'm going to read this part out. Are you ready? So this is Damned Connecticut says, you've publicly questioned the Snedeker story. What things in particular don't you believe? What leads you to question their credibility? Do you have any particular evidence?
Who's this they're asking?
Ray Garton.
Right. Okay.
His reply.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't keep their story straight, for starters. The family was a mess, but their problems were not supernatural, and they weren't going to get the kind of help they needed from the Warrens. At the time I was with them, Carmen Snedeker was running some kind of illegal interstate lottery scam that I don't think I was supposed to find out about. But when I did, she repeatedly urged me not to mention it in the book and not to tell anyone. Their son, around whom the entire story centred, was nowhere to be found. I never met him. I was allowed to talk to him briefly on the phone, but as soon as he started telling me that the things he saw in the house went away after he'd been medicated, Carmen abruptly ended the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The Warrens repeatedly told me they had videotapes of the actual supernatural activity shot in the house, and they were going to show it to me while I was there, but they never did. They said they couldn't find the tape. I never saw the inside of the house, the former funeral home in the story, because the people living there at the time wanted absolutely nothing to do with the circus, and they claimed there was no problems at all in the house. The Warrens explained that this was because the house had been cleansed by a priest who had performed an exorcism, but to the best of my knowledge, the Catholic Church had absolutely nothing to do with the Warrens in any official way, and there are questions about the legitimacy of the priests who worked with them.
Okay.
There is also, I've got to find that part where it says that the priests in the story, they refused to give the name, as you said before, and the Warrens got very, very angry when they were pressed on this.
Now, do you have the part here I found?
She's so excited. I haven't finished yet.
I know. It says, after interviewing the family members and working his way through the reported facts of the case, Garton has stated that several things just didn't add up, as you said. Unsure of how to handle it, he reportedly approached Ed Warren and explained his dilemma to him and asked him for advice. According to Garton, Warren replied with the following advice. So this is a little bit different from what you said.
Oh, okay. Different one. Okay.
Everyone who comes to us is crazy. Otherwise, why would they come to us? You've got some of the story. Just use what works and makes the rest up and make it scary. You write scary books, right? That's why we hired you. Mm-hmm. So just make it up and make it scary.
Let's just keep going, right? We have to push through this because I can see the...
Seething.
She is seething. There is steam coming out the nose and the ears. All right, now I'm going to go into the Warrens a little bit.
Yep.
Now, a lot of this information came from a guy called Joe Nickel. Now, he is a skeptic, and just let me quickly refer to some of the, the resources I've used. So there's a website, theparanormalscholar.com. Centerforinquiry.org, livescience.com,
yeah,
and rogerebert.com. And I also had one from the skeptics as well. So this guy is a really well-known skeptic. So once again, we've got to think of the bias here,
that's true.
He's not going to want these stories to be true. So he attacks them left, right, and center. But you guys are clever enough. You can make up your own mind. Anyway, so the Warrens are called.
Yes.
Apparently Carmen had a friend who said, no, don't call them. You don't need the Warrens. This is not paranormal, but she ignored them and called the Warrens. So enter the notorious Warrens, demonologist Ed and his clairvoyant wife, Lorraine. Although some saw them as sincere religious people, others called them charlatans and scaremongers. Fancy that.
That's so unfair.
That's not what they looked like in that last movie we saw as they were dancing together and looking so longingly into each other's eyes. So basically they have this, it's almost like a plan. They would arrive with a lot of fanfare at the haunted location, and typically the people that they would arrive at would be Catholics. And soon transform whatever the case was into a demonic one and then secure a lucrative book deal.
Yes, and this happens time and time again, which
funny
is...
Funny about that, huh?
That's the interesting bit about it.
So now this Joe Nickel guy appeared with Carmen Snedeker on a couple of TV shows, The Maury Povich Show, sorry if I've said that wrong, and the Sally Jesse Raphael, I do remember that one. And he found Ed to be blustering, would-be bullying, demon huckersteering type of person. And I actually saw the transcript of this interview, and Ed just wouldn't listen. He just wanted to talk over the top of people, he wasn't willing to listen to anything that anyone, and at some stage they were going to storm off the set. They were quite aggressive. Now, they questioned them about the exorcism. So they said couple claim to have arranged for an exorcism to be performed at the house, but have never provided any substantiating evidence to prove this. When questioned on television at the time, Ed referred to the priest who conducted the exorcism as Father A, mm-hmm. who had supposedly appeared on television before. When pressed to give more details, Ed responded with a disproportionate aggression by saying, "Father A, that's the name I give you. I don't have to give you anything else." Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very spiritual person.
Look, you can imagine from one point of view their frustration if they're continually being asked for details, because this is a big story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get to a point where you go, I can't keep on doing this. You're here just to rubbish me. And I totally understand that.
Yeah. And look, Ed accuses one of the neighbours as being paid off by the landlord mm-hmm. to dispute the Snedeker's claim. Once again, that could be true.
Could be true.
Because they don't want their house to be seen as being haunted. But when once they came off stage, Ed made veiled threatening asides to him and offstage swore like a sailor.
Wow.
Mm, but once again, we've only got his word on it, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So as he, in another interview when questioned by reporters about the priest who supposedly conducted an exorcism on the property, Ed once again became hostile, shouting and just waving his arms around aggressively. "This is baloney," he said on camera. "Come on, let's get out of here." And after that, he started to get up and walk out. So he gets very aggressive when questioned.
Apparently there's one documentary that can be found on YouTube where Ed and Lorraine and Alan and Carmen are interviewed together.
Yeah.
And Carmen's at that stage where I don't know whether she's been bullied into submission or she's gone, "I just can't cope with this anymore." And she just can't talk.
No, well, they don't get the chance to talk because Ed's talking over the top of them. And I've just realised we're getting a bit long in the tooth on this one, so I need to wrap it up. So they also talk about Lorraine's so-called mediumistic abilities. And that was how they got the story about the mortician who worked in the funeral home and committed vile acts on the dead, and that's why all these unnatural actions have drawn in demonic entities.
Mm-hmm.
So it's her word and her word alone mm-hmm. that there was this necrophilia going on.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it when paranormal investigators go into a location where they're supposedly haunting, immediately go to there's bad things that's happened here?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. Always jump to the worst. So the house was supposedly exorcised, and that's what the Warrens are saying, is the house was exorcised, and that's why people afterwards didn't experience any demonic activity, because they solved the problem.
They solved the problem, yeah.
Of course.
Yep.
And then there was also Johnny Zaffis, who was brought in to learn the family business.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he was brought in, to learn the family business. And look, I quite like Johnny Zaffis. I've seen him on TV several times. He seems like a really nice guy. Maybe he was younger then and a little bit more naive. I don't know. Or maybe the Warrens are right. Who knows? But there was this great quote. Right, I found it. But Renata, you were saying that there is another book that's being written.
Well, apparently. So this is going back a bit. I'm not quite sure when this was written, but it actually states in the notes here that John Zaffis and Chip Coffey were writing a book about the family home and what happened there. And they had a working title. The working title was called Demons from the Dark or Demons in the Dark. And when this particular article was written, there wasn't an expected release date. So I don't know whether that book actually came out or not.
Maybe there's too much truth coming out. Anyway, I found these great conclusions here. Basically, with everything that's going on there, it's really hard to make a decision either way what happened. There is no official documentation. There is no physical evidence. All you've got is the word of the Snedekers, the word of the Warrens, and the word of the other witnesses and the neighbours.
Mm-hmm.
So
and they're all biased.
Everyone has their own bias. So yeah. How do you make up your mind? My thing with this is that the guy that wrote the story said that nobody could get their story straight. And it wasn't just that it kept changing.
Mm.
And yeah. It changed to seem to suit what was required in the storyline, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to leave it in Garton's hands to end this off. Since writing the book, I've learned a lot that leaves no doubt in my mind about the fraudulence of the Warrens and the Snedekers. Not that I had much doubt anyway. I've talked to other writers who have been hired to write books for the Warrens, always horror writers like myself, and their experience with the Warrens have also been almost identical to my own.
Wow.
So that is from somebody who was hired by them.
Mm.
And made money out of it.
Mm.
And if anything, he'd probably want to try and keep that quiet, not talk about it.
Because that would ruin his reputation.
That's right. But he's actually spoken up.
Okay. Well, that's been a very interesting story. And when I approached this and I said, let's do this, I never thought it was going to turn like this.
Mm.
I thought it was just going to be another normal.
Wow. It's an Amityville Horror all over again.
All over again.
Is this house haunted? Is this a true haunting?
The thing that strikes me here is that there is no evidence.
No.
Okay, all we have is hearsay.
And we have Philip, who was a drug user and has admitted to fiddling and trying to rape people. We have people who are behind in their rent and can't pay. We have a lot of stuff that's going on there.
The thing that strikes me is I feel for Carmen. We hear almost nothing from the father once it gets to that point.
Mm-hmm.
I feel for Carmen from the point of view of she's trying to protect her son. What yeah. I don't get is then her turning to doing psychic work. All of a sudden, from nothing, she is now a big psychic medium
yeah.
who has all the abilities under the sun.
Yeah.
So if all of this was so traumatic, why would you then go into the business?
Yeah. And do you know the thing is that is really making me cranky is that the Warrens are being portrayed in these movies as
the saviors.
The saviors, the most beautiful people on this earth, so much in love. And then if you look at the backstories, that's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's really horrible. Anyway, I'm going to say it. This is not a true haunting.
No, I have to agree with you. It is absolutely not a true haunting. There is no, there's not a Skerrick.
No, I think it was all to protect Philip.
Yep.
Anyway, guys, thank you for joining us on this huge journey of true hauntings. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we did digging down into it. Make sure that you have subscribed and that you can find us on YouTube as well. Anne and Renata, lots of stuff that we're doing over there. You can find us on Facebook. Come join the community. And until then, we will all see you on
the dark side.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of True Hauntings. If you like the show, give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. For more on Anne and Renata, follow @AnneandRenata on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube.